Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Everybody, welcome to this week's edition of the Terry's Talking Podcast. I'm David Campbell, your host, and I'm joined by Mr. Terry Pluto. And Terry, spring is in the air. You could smell it yesterday, and that means baseball is not far behind, right? Coming up.
I always am excited when baseball season comes, just because that's the type of family I grew up in. And this is just several readers of email. Well, didn't you go to Arizona? Aren't you going? I've had a illness is basically something very close to us, and my wife and I and our family had a major stroke, so we had to change things around, and so I don't feel quite as connected to the team as normal, because I love going down there in the middle of March. You get to take a look at the different prospects and that. So nonetheless, I've been, as they say, I have sources, and I have been talking to them, and so it's going to be fascinating, but I have to admit, I feel for Stephen Vogt.
First-year manager, and they're just piecing this roster together as they can, right, Terry?
Even the worst thing a manager, especially an experienced manager, can have, Dave Campbell, what part of the team would it be? What part of the team can make you look like a total idiot as a manager?
The pitching rotation and
the bullpen, staff. Especially the bullpen. Because, yes, pitching in general, but especially the bullpen. Because, all right, so your starter gets hit. Then you go, well, now it's like you're supposed to pick the right guy to come in at the right time to get that hitter out. And right now, if you're Stephen Vogt, you're out there, do I go with Tim Herron? Do I go with Hunter Gaddis? Do I go with Eli Morgan? Do I go with Kate Smith? You know, because we're innings and innings away from Manuel Clase. You know, how is Barlow? There isn't an arm out there other than Clase that inspires much confidence in me.
So, Terry, we got a lot to get to here. I want to ask you about the roster for opening day. Guardians are opening Thursday night. We also, there's a lot coming to the NFL meetings in Florida, where Mary Kay Cabot is down reporting on Brown's doings, and the Cavs have hit an interesting spell. I want to ask you if you think it was good that they admitted they were exhausted. I want to hear what you have to say about mm-hmm. that. And we've got some letters from everybody writing about foul ball stories, so we'll get to that. But while we're on the Guardians, Terry, what surprised you the most? I know you've been writing about Miles Straw and what happened with him, but what was the biggest surprise from the roster? Or were there more than one surprise? Was there more than one surprise for you as you looked at what they did?
Well, the Straw is a shocking thing because of the $19 million he's owed. And I mean, and I give him credit for sending him down, because some teams would say, now they're just going to make fun of us even more. We're paying the guy $19 million. Let's see if he can shape up. And then on top of it, Yanni Ordiaz, of course, has hit 23 homers last year with the Astros. He was in the trade. He's going to be their starting catcher. I mean, it's just bad on so many levels. Now, confession time. I liked the Straw deal when it was made. I liked his profile. 305 in the minors he hit. He was hitting like 275 when they made it. Granted, not a lot of power at all, but he's an elite center fielder with the right speed to become a leadoff hitter or the number nine, you know, second leadoff hitter. The profile was there. And when they gave him the extension, that was the kind of thing that had been done in the past very effectively. A guy has one good year or two good years, and you come in, and it was not outrageous. And then he stopped. He forgot how to hit. I mean, you're talking 1,100 at-bats and one homer and, 40 doubles or something. It was terrible. I don't understand how a guy that athletic just totally lost it. And then finally, David, they're saying he's worked hard. He went to these two special hitting sessions. I have a feeling they gave him some messages on how they wanted him to approach things at the plate. And even though he had a 300 this spring, they didn't see it. And this is done to get his attention.
Well, and Terry, we've talked about this before, if you're doing the right things and if you put in the effort, they will give you a second chance, right?
Mm-hmm. And oh, sure.
Not only did he gain 10 pounds of what looked like muscle, but he also, and this is from Paul Hoynes' reporting, and I think you might have written it too, he went to he worked with Chris Valleca the whole offseason with the Guardians hitting coaches to try and revamp his swing and to get some, and it's not just power that's been the problem, it's just making contact has been an issue for him. And I think because he went through that, I think every fan's first reaction when they saw that they were waving him was, oh, they finally had enough. And this is the end of Miles Straw. And what a disaster this has been. But actually, right after that, Chris Antonetti was seen sitting at the game talking to him and they were working it out. And it's like, hey, here's what we want you to do. So I think you're right. This was hey, you put in a lot of work. This is your second chance, but we're going to get your attention. We're sending you to Columbus to fix the swing. And let's see what happens. And what Chris Antonetti said, we're going to need him flat out, right? They said, we're going to need Miles Straw this season.
Well, I mean, you break down the outfield. You got Kwan in left, and now here we go. Esteban Florio's in center. He was terrible this spring. I mean, they just decided, we're going to go with him. It probably came down to him or Straw. We'll go with him. And then if that's no good, then we could go back to Straw. And, of course, now Freeman is the guy that captivated them this spring. Now, there are a lot of shortstops who became center fielders or outfielders. Chipper Jones was one. I was shocked because I just kind of Googled it. Gary Sheffield
was some shortstop. List you had. Robin Yount,
Paul Molitor. I mean, those are top ones. There's a lot of other guys. The one guy who flipped it the other way is Kipnis was an outfielder in college. And then he went to second base, but usually it's the other way around. And I remember talking to Manning about it, and he says, if you're a shortstop and a good athlete, you'll be able to learn how to play the outfield. That shouldn't be a big problem for Freeman. Freeman's a 311 hitter in the minors, not a lot of power, but they think he could hit 280 to 300 if you played regular. They're going to try to find out. Then in right field, you got Laureano, and you got Brennan. I mean, there's all kinds. Look, you got one outfielder right now. Stephen Kwan. That's it that you know. So Miles Straw could go down there and hit. I hear they're going to put Angel Martinez in the outfield. I had a long talk with Tom Hamilton about some of the prospects. He really likes, and Tom does not go gaga over prospects, I may add. He really likes Martinez. He thinks Martinez has a chance to develop into some power. And so that's encouraging. Of course, DeLauder and Manzardo are down there. So they've got plenty. So if you go Martinez, DeLauder, Manzardo, and then you have Straw, you're right there before you even get guys like Jonathan Rodriguez. But those guys right there, offer some hope. This is sort of the first wave of players we're going to look at now. And then I think we'll have three or four tidal waves of call-ups as we go along.
Yeah, I brought up Tyler Freeman last week because I thought they might give him a run at shortstop if they weren't getting what they wanted. But it looks like Rocchio's going to have first crack at that, and they're moving Freeman out to center field. He's too valuable and playing too well to have him sitting on the bench. You know what I'm saying? I'm glad they found a spot for him because I think that's a good first spot for him to start the season.
I always thought Freeman was a second baseman, David. I just did not like him at short a lot. I mean, he's okay. But you have – by the way, Rocchio, once he was kind of assured he's on the team or whatever, if you look, he really started to hit. And maybe that's what he needed. Francona was always saying that the spring training thing is some guys, it doesn't bother them playing for a job, and other guys could almost melt under the pressure. And he said as a player himself, he went through both, where he was confident, and then later on he was just sweating it all the time. He says that's one of the reasons he instituted the telling guys as early as possible they made the team. And I think he convinced Antonetti to do this as opposed to kind of waiting to sweat down at the end. I remember like when Manny Atka was here in Wedge, they often went down the last 3 or 4 days. And I would come down right at the end. And then I discovered with Francona the first time, by the time I got there, they've just about made all the main roster cuts, even though some guys were there, because that was his feeling. So, yeah, they're giving Rocchio a real shot at it. Arias are going to – and Arias is very gifted as a defender. He can play all kinds of different places. I don't know if he's ever going to hit. So there you are. But basically, how many – who can hit for power on this team, David?
Jose and Josh Naylor and maybe Bo Naylor.
That's my list.
Is that your list too?
That's my three. I mean, maybe – you know, a couple of years ago, I believe Jimenez had 17 homers, 15 or 17. But I don't want him jacking the ball. So if he could hit 15 homers and get back up to, you know, an OPS over 800 and hit around 280 and play second base as well as anybody I've seen since Robbie Alomar, I'm all in on that. And remember, Roberto's prospect from a couple of years ago.
Juan Brito?
No, that's my prospect. My prospects never make it. My prospects are like Owen Miller. I forgot who else. It's a bad list. Hers, the great one of all time, is after Stephen Kwan played 1 year in A-ball, she sees them with me in this game. And they've started, and we didn't know, so we're looking him up. And she, oh, I really like him. I think he'll make it. That was it. But anyway, a couple years ago, it's Rocchio. That was her guy. Now, she doesn't sit there looking at prospect lists, so she didn't know that Kwan really wasn't on anybody's list or that Rocchio was high. She watches the game. She makes her call.
Yeah, and the thing with Kwan that was great about her call on that was, like, he's not the most physically imposing guy who's going to hit the ball 450 feet. Like, she just picked up on the nuances of his game, which I love.
Yeah, like, she was big on Chu. That was one of her guys. Coco Chris. So if you think there's a pattern there. Smaller guys who can run, who's athletic. Now, of course, she's only 5'1", and she played on the first ever Hiram women's basketball team. So she kind of goes towards the smaller athlete. But see, that's also when, you know, I just did there, and I did it intentionally. The fun of baseball. One of the great things about baseball, like I told this story now, but Roberta with Rocchio and Kwan or guys that I like, is that you could pick a guy, whether it's somebody that you actually maybe got the spring training to saw, or else maybe you're somebody who studies stats and you just kind of looked at, well, I like how this guy has trended through the minors. Or maybe he just comes up briefly and you think, boy, if they ever give that guy a chance, he could be my guy. I think you're more able to kind of target prospects and play the prospect game in baseball than all the other sports because there's more jobs and just there's, you have more exposure to the younger players in baseball. So that's a fun thing that I enjoy about it. And by the way, you better get ready to play the prospect game this year because you don't have a lot of veteran games.
Yeah, and I get it. Like, the you know, Guardians fans are always like, oh, they never spend money on this team. And I think as I've gone along in my fandom through the years, like, I've grown to appreciate the art of team building a lot more. And with, like you said, Terry, with all the games, 162 games, you can follow a prospect and see them grow and how they fit into the puzzle of what the team is going to become. And I think that's really fun. And I think I've grown to appreciate that a lot more. And that is part of the fun of baseball. You got that right.
And with all the data online now for the minors and everything else, you really can, you know, you target your guy, then you watch how he played it out. And besides, if you want to go see him play at Lake County or at Akron, like I was watching last year, they signed Chase DeLauder. And after about 6 weeks, he's hitting 380 or whatever. I'm like, I'm going to Lake County to see this. What is this? And so I went down there, saw him, played a doubleheader, and came back and wrote this ode to Chase DeLauder. I talked to a couple of people when I was down there. And then I talked to some, I've been watching. I've been on him for the last 3 weeks, you know, some fans and that. So that's what's fun. Akron, the same thing. That's the blessing of having the teams close to us. Akron's a real good place to watch minor league baseball because the double-A is kind of a cutting point where – if you have a really good double-A season, odds are you're at least going to see the major leagues, especially if you're a hitter. Eastern League is tough to hit. The weather's cold. The trips are long on buses. And on top of that, you'll run into some 25, 27-year-old guys throwing breaking balls and just stuff you don't see elsewhere. So as you could tell, I do love baseball, and even when I'm not real high on the team like this year.
All right, before I ask you for your season prediction for the Guardians, what are you looking for with Steven Vogt as a first-year manager this early, first month of the season? What are you going to be watching to see how he's adjusting to his first time as a major league manager?
How he handles failure, because until you're in that chair, or even until you're running a department of work, a teaching a class the first time, when you think you have these great ideas and it just doesn't work. Or, as Francona said, you actually can do everything right that makes sense, and a guy gets hurt. A player actually finds out that his girlfriend dumped him. You know, all these things that we don't know about. Like I mentioned at this opening, when you have a very bad bullpen, you could look foolish. You know, a guy like Francona had been through so much. I mean, I don't know if the Guardians will ever have a manager show up like this guy at their doorstep wanting to manage there. Because by the time he had gone, I believe he had been, I always forget whether it's 4 or 5 years in Philadelphia. But either way, he had gone through rebuilding, getting his butt kicked, all that. Then he had been fired. Then he came back to Cleveland as an advisor. And then he went back as a coach. And then he got the Red Sox job. So he went to that. Trips to the World Series, highest market, intense baseball town you could manage in, got worn down physically, gets fired, comes here, and this is his second home. You know, Daddy Tito played there, and he comes in here, and he always just kept saying it's pure baseball. He loved that part of it, even with the lesser budget, and I think he trusted the front office. See, once Tito got here, I just had the feeling they would never be bad. That he would be able to ride out whatever it was. I'm just saying they're always going to be good. But, I mean, the remarkable stat on Tito was going into the 23 season. That changed in 23. But going into that, his first 9 years, they only played 19 games where they were eliminated from the playoff race. They were
incredible.
Never, I mean, even in the 1 year they were 80-82, they were kind of hanging in a bad division.
There were some years back in the 70s when people wondered if the Indians would win 19 games.
That's true. And there were times in the 60s and 70s, you wonder if they would be there next year because they moved to New Orleans or somewhere. I mean, it was
that's an incredible
it
stat.
Was that, and I lived through it. So that's it. But now with Steven, I mean, there's going to be times. It's going to be rocky. Maybe I'm reading all this wrong, but I just think it's going to be really hard. And they're going to hope that he's up to it. They think he is, but you just don't know.
Yeah, I'm kind of adjacent to where you're at there, Terry. You were asking me who can hit for power on this team, and I think it's an old Moneyball thing, but we don't care about power. We care about run production.
Sure.
Right? And they have a run production coach, like a specialist on the staff right now to help produce runs. And just reading between the lines, like with what Steven Vogt has been saying this during spring training, like he talks a lot about base running and doing the little things right. And going, you talked about what he's going to do when there's failure. Tito was exceptional at maintaining a standard of hustle and accountability in that clubhouse. And when a guy didn't run to first base on a grounder, he heard about it, and he might not play the next day. And Tito handled a lot of that stuff behind the scenes. So I want to see, like, if they're going to be manufacturing runs through base running and other way, and hitting to spots or whatever situational things. If that doesn't happen, I'm really interested to see how he holds guys accountable, because they're going to need to maintain that standard of hustle, putting pressure on the defense. And as a manager, he's going to have to hold that standard pretty high to where it's been in the past if they're going to play that way. I'm interested to see that.
And he's going to have to make sure that he's totally simpatico with Jose Ramirez. Jose Ramirez, and Ramirez, by the way, was texting the Guardians to get Austin Hedges. He feels that he and Austin could be, because he lost Ahmed Rosario, but he felt that he Austin and Ahmed 2 years ago in 22 ran the clubhouse, and that he needed more, basically a sergeant at arms here. And so that was it. You know, fans can go all this and Hedges can't hit and this and that. But you notice how the players have talked about him. And this is an integral to a rookie manager coming in. So now what could help Vogt with the pitching staff is having Carl Willis back. I thought that was critical, because I'm sure Carl could have probably got out of his contract and gone somewhere else. They should be thankful Tito didn't like decide, oh, maybe I will manage next year after all, because they could have lost probably him and some others. So I'm, you know, we look at all that, but your point is correct. They have to respect him enough to play that way where he consistently put pressure on the other team, because they're just not going to hit that many homers. Now, 2 years ago, they were second last in homers in the majors, but they were like 15th in runs scored. So that's fine. Last year, they hit no homers and they scored no runs. So that was just bad.
All right. So, Terry, it's time to predict your Guardians record for the 2024 season. And I know you're saying this might not be one of your – this might be one of your lower predictions ever. Well, where are you at with this?
All right. Great, Karnak. Here we go. I see the number 90. Is that a win number or a loss number?
Whoa, I'm going to say a loss number.
Yes,
really?
Yeah. I got a 72 and 90. I just think it's going to be really hard. I hope I'm wrong, and I'm often wrong, but that's where I'm at.
I'm going to predict
now,
70.
Now, by the way, now if they trade for three guys, you know,
it all changes.
Or whatever, in the next 3 days, but I write this thing for the weekend, I have the right to change it. But given the current makeup of the roster, that's what I have them.
All right, 72 and 90. I'm going to say 76 and 86. I'm not much higher than you, but it's so weird, Terry, because when they trade Shane Bieber is going to have such an impact on that record. And if they do it in May, it might be one thing. And if they do it in July, it might be another. Like, it's that's kind of the linchpin of the whole thing to me. So we'll see.
But whenever they do trade them, the odds of them getting anybody – well, first of all, you won't get a starter back like Bieber, because a team that trades for Bieber won't be trading you a rotation starter. They'll be trading you either some prospects or maybe a hitter that could help you right away. So you're losing him. By the way, and Hamilton and I talked to some others about Bieber and checked the radar gun readings. I mean, it's real. This guy's got back to throwing 93, 94, and that makes a big difference because – you know, the dreaded spin rates, they love the spin rates, you know, not just Velo there. He's got the spin rate back on his breaking ball, too. So that's a key thing. And then I have to admit, I hope I'm wrong, but I am very leery of McKenzie staying healthy. You know, he's kind of like he's got to prove that he can. And I hope the Gavin Williams thing is what they said, just to he strained his elbow throwing those weighted balls, or I don't know. I just wonder about some of the stuff with these training techniques. You know, for all this stuff, all these things they do, they got weighted balls. They've got all these, you know, everything. They're counting. They're all, and they still have all these sore arms, and they have pitch counts, and they have innings limitations. And I know I'm sounding old and grumpy, but I don't get it.
I guess it's the nature of the pitchers. Maybe they should just have him go out on the farm and work like Bob Feller used to do and have him throw hay bales around. Maybe that'll solve it. So.
Maybe.
All right, Terry, let's take a break. When we come back, we're going to get into the Cavaliers, and I want to tell you why Marcus Morris makes me think of a hockey player. So we'll get into that and more when we come back on Terry's Talking.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We're back on Terry's Talking. David Campbell, Terry Pluto. We're going to get into the Cavaliers before we hit the Browns. But, Terry, last night, it's been an interesting few days for the Cavs. I guess we can go in reverse order. Well, let's start at the beginning. So, Sunday night, they go to Miami and get just pulverized by 40 points. It was over early. And Chris Fedor was down there covering the game and put a headline. And there was more than one person who used this phrase. They were all talking about, "We're exhausted. We're exhausted from the injuries. We're exhausted from the schedule. We're exhausted because it's getting late in the season." I'm thinking about the Cavs, and Cavs fans are waiting to see what this team does in the playoffs. And toughness was a big theme after the Knicks bullied them around last year. And I'm just wondering, like, do you want it out there that you're exhausted? Like, I don't see a lot of other teams admitting, even if you are exhausted, and yes, it's been rough and everybody's been hurt. But, like, why throw that out there? It seems like you're giving your opponent some ammunition for later. But maybe I'm reading too much into that. What did you think of the that we're exhausted?
Well, the test will be how they play the rest of this week. You know, they bounced back against Charlotte Monday and played well. Sometimes when you feel as a coach, because I believe JB also brought it up, when you feel as a coach that your team's confidence is getting really shaken or whatever, you may want to put that in there, say, you know, we're not as bad as it seems. We're just really tired now. We just need to catch our breath, and we're going to be fine. That would be my – I don't think he's giving him an excuse. I think what he's trying to do is make sure that they don't lose some of that confidence that has carried them through this season with a lot of different guys out. And really looking at Garland, to me, he does look exhausted most of the time. I actually watched – because I didn't see the Minnesota game, and so I was looking at the tape of that this morning, and I was surprised how often, it was two or three times that he's bringing the ball up the court, and guys are coming from behind and taking it away. He's not cognizant of it. He's not moving as fast. And now Minnesota's a really good defensive team. Nonetheless, it was sort of embarrassing to see that, and also, you know, how he's struggling so much when he gets double-teamed. They're blitzing him, and so that's, I would like to see when they're watching that and it looks to me like Garland's tired, put the ball in LeVert's hand, bring Porter in, take some of the pressure off him. I mean, this guy trying to go 36, 38 minutes and score big, I don't think he could physically do it night after night.
Well, and at this point of the season too, Terry, like what is there to play for? Right. You know, I guess there's playoff positioning, but in the end, like, wouldn't you rather have your guys be fresh? So I wonder if they will take that.
I hope
approach
so.
Approach the rest of the way and spread those minutes out a little bit. But
One other thing on Garland. Watch when he's playing now. Maybe he'll do better on this, but I did watch part of that game, and was it Charlotte game or what? Anyway, parts of two of the recent games. When he's going to the rim now, especially if he's trying to make a layup, watch how he's really falling away as he's thrown. That's why he's missing those layups. I think because he got his jaw broken and he's been knocked around, he's shying away from some contact there. And so that's another problem with him. Now, some of this could be better, and I just think a lot of it goes away when Mitchell gets back. Remember we talked about Mitchell being the sun and the rest of the players being the solar system, the planets around him. Well, it's just like the eclipse hit, and the sun is not shining right now, and the other planets are trying to find their orbit, and because that whole thing was established with Mitchell, and on top of it, Strus is so valuable to them, and not having him, because, see, he could really help with the ball handling. Have you heard, are they saying, like, anything about him?
Not that I've heard lately.
Yeah. That's like
kind of a day-to-day thing.
Mystery, so. Yeah. Day-to-day, we're into like 3 or 4 weeks now.
Yeah. So I guess what I wanted to get into about last night's game, mm-hmm. We're taping this late on Tuesday. So Cavs get buried by 40 in Miami. They come back home. They're playing Charlotte. And late in the first half, I think, I don't have the exact minute, but Marcus Morris comes out and just puts an elbow into Nick Richards of the Hornets. You know, coming down the lane. Marcus Morris is like, I'm an old school player. You don't come down the lane without getting challenged. Puts an elbow into him and gets kicked out for a flagrant two.
Mm-hmm.
And Evan Mobley said after the game, and the Cavs won handily, that everything shifted after that play. And it did, Terry. Marcus Morris's thing last night by getting kicked out reminded me of when you're watching a hockey game and a team is really flat, and some third or fourth line guy goes out there and puts a good clean check on somebody and takes the puck and starts to mix it up in the corners. And everybody starts to sit up on the bench and like, all right, we're in a game now. Mm-hmm. And that was what it was like last night, was that Marcus Morris, this guy that they brought in on a 10-day contract, basically just comes in. He the quotes after the game, he's like, I'm just being physical. I'm trying to set the tone. You're rolling down the paint, catching lobs, and we're going to stop that type of S. It was exactly what he said after the game. And he's like, I'm not putting up with it. And I think this is the kind of guy that the Cavs need heading into the playoffs, is someone who will say, you know, we're not putting up with this anymore. We're not going to let Jalen Brunson come down the lane and get off whatever shot he wants. I'm coming in there with a nice hard foul or an elbow or whatever it takes to slow this thing down. I think the Cavs need something like that. Do you agree?
On top of that, to double down on your point, there were, now, on the tape I was watching, they didn't play together a lot, but there were some moments when Tristan was out there with Morris, and they shut down that lane. And those two guys are old school. And I really, in fact, I was telling Roberta, because she was watching a little bit with me, I said, look at this. Now, this is different, and it's what they need. So you're absolutely right, because, see, Morris also brings some shooting skills or whatever. I mean, to this day, Tristan can't decide. He's still shooting his free throws right-handed, but, you know, he might as well drop kick him at the rim. I mean, it's just not his thing. But he's relentless, you know, on the offensive boards. He'll body check people, too. So I do think that does equip them, to your point, whether it's the Knicks or Miami or some of the others, and they're also going to challenge. See, both of those guys have been around long enough to challenge some of the younger guys, and you do at times in the NBA because of just the way the salary structure is set. Guys like Morris end up popping on the market at midseason, and you could grab them and get some mileage out of them.
Yeah, and you know, Jared Allen's having an amazing season, right? Like he's doing double doubles every night, but he and Evan Mobley are just not wired that way. Like no. They're just not wired to come with a hard foul. I mean, geez, back in the '90s, the way the Bulls and the Knicks went at each other, you couldn't go down the lane without ended up getting knocked down like every time, and that's just not their game. So I think you're right, Terry. Having Tristan Thompson and Morris be around these guys is going to show them, hey, listen, this is the playoffs, and this is what happens. And this is the way it has to be.
And watching a little bit of the tape of those couple of games, too, was driving me nuts. I mean, Jarrett was putting up good numbers. But so many times, he's running down the floor, and they're missing him. They're just not even looking, especially Garland, but others, too. They're missing him. Reward this guy. He shoots 60% from the field. And then there's one that then talked to him. And then I do think the veteran players have talked to him. Man, when you get the ball, will you shoot it? I mean, there was one. One play, he gets about like 5 feet from the basket. He turns and throws a semi behind the back pass to Okoro in the corner for the corner three. No, just remember, yes, three are better than two, but two are better than none. Put the ball in the hoop. You know you can score. And see, I could just see that, you know, one of the players probably would spice that language up a little bit and to deliver the point. So you're absolutely correct. I like the hockey analogy. I didn't think of it. That's really good.
Oh, cool. All right, so real quick on the Cavs, Terry, they're 44-28. Do you think it matters where they end up in the standings in the Eastern Conference for the playoffs in terms of 3-4? I mean, does it matter, or is it just you'd rather have them rested and healthy than be worrying about that?
You got to get them rested, you know, because you got to get Mitchell back. I mean, let's say if you don't get Mitchell back and he doesn't get a game or two in, I mean, I don't feel good about anything. I'm on my, you know, right now they're in the eclipse. They need the sunshine back.
And everybody can wear their glasses, their eclipse glasses, and watch the playoffs when he's back, right?
Yeah, and okay. I really would like to feel better about the stuff with Struth. I don't think anyone expected this to go on as long, and he has a history of playing a lot of games. So that's a concern. You know, and if I were JB, you would see more a Porter at the point. Your point guard is tired. And, you know, you would see with LeVert maybe having the ball a little more. I know he likes the idea of LeVert playing the backup point when Garland's out. But to me, Porter doesn't play like a rookie. I mean, he plays like a solid veteran backup point guard. So you could. I mean, you put him on, well, they signed him to a contract, but you made him available. I think 10 teams would want him like yesterday.
All right, Terry. Well, they do have 10 games left, and they have a return matchup against the Charlotte Hornets in Charlotte on Wednesday night at 7, and then they have a home game Friday against the Sixers, and then they are gone for the Women's West Final Coast. Four coming to town there. So they're going to take a West Coast swing. Starting on Sunday, they're at Denver, and then they're going all through Utah, Phoenix, Lakers, Clippers, that whole thing, while the Women's Final Four is down at the Fieldhouse. So we'll see how these next 10 games go. I'm really interested to see how they use guys and who's playing how many minutes, and we'll keep tabs on that. So, All right, Terry, on to the Browns. Mary Kay Cabot, our colleague, has been at the league meetings down in Orlando this week. I don't know. There's a lot coming out of it. Is there anything you wanted to talk about, the stadium stuff? I know you're writing a column for tomorrow morning about your thoughts on the stadium. I guess we could start with that, right?
Well, it's a big story. It's one that's going to go on and on and on. I have two main thoughts on the stadium. Number one, I want a dome. And number two, I think it's really dumb to put it on the lakefront. Because that is valuable real estate here that Cleveland has wasted for years and years. It's almost like when the Browns moved and they had to build a stadium, they didn't even give a thought to putting it somewhere else. Well, let's just knock down that old one and slap up that new one, because everything about that project was rushed. Well, we have owned that real estate there, so we can knock out the old one, put it in the new. We don't have to worry about infrastructure. Ready to go. Here we are. And as I called it, that stadium has sort of gone the way of the shopping mall. It really has. It was, maybe it was a decent idea at one time, but if you notice, like, name your shopping malls, they're different now. They're gone. And there is a whole other way of looking at stuff. And so even though, to me, putting $1 billion, which is supposed to cost, into refurbishing the stadium is just stupid. It just is. So that's where I'm at. You know, the Haslams have thrown out Brook Park, or there's land in Cleveland. I know we're doing a lot of work on other possibilities, you know, on that for upcoming stories. But I think it would be, it's time to put a target on the wall. Dome or no dome, A or B. Lakefront or no lakefront, A or B. Pick, and then figure out a way to get it done. Then start to argue over the money.
The dome thing has got to happen, Terry. I remember when the stadium was built for 1999, when the Browns came back. The Browns fans had their pride stepped on, and they're like, "We want an outdoor stadium. We're an outdoor team, and the weather. We're AFC North." And it was very important to the fans, and I think to the team, to reestablish that identity back then. But man, you look around, and you're writing about this in the morning in your column, but like, you look around at Indianapolis and Minneapolis and all these places that are used in those buildings dozens and dozens and dozens times a year, and the economic development. And if there's public money going into a building, it darn well better have benefits for the public. And an outdoor stadium like they have now does not do that. And I think you're right. I think an indoor venue, or at least a retractable roof, maybe if you could do both, would be the way to go. It's just, it has to happen.
A dome itself is cheaper than doing a retractable roof from what my research. But how about this? Right. The Bills are spending $1.6 billion on an outdoor stadium in the North Pole, basically. That's dumb, too. You might as well just go all in. Nashville's building a dome for $2.1 billion. Both of those places, it's about half public money, half private. Now we're going to hear the Maslins have the money to, and they do. They got $11 billion from Warren Buffett for Flying J. They're not going to do it. The NFL hates when any owner goes out and just builds a stadium. Now, as far as my research showed, there's only been three. One was Gillette Stadium. I believe Robert Kraft built that. And that was in 02. I forgot the amount of money, but it was 02. And then in 2010, MetLife Stadium. That surprised me, in New York, or Meadowlands. That was all private money. And then the last, and there's an asterisk next to this one, which is SoFi Stadium in L.A., because they got two NFL teams there. So those are the only three that I could find of at least, you know, the last 30 or 40 years that were done solely with private funds. Now, David, why does the NFL not want owners just to go spend the whole amount of money on a stadium?
Because they don't want all 32 owners to have to do it, and they want the money.
You got
so
it.
They don't have to pay it, yeah.
You got it, exactly. They want to be able to go to other places, just like I'm sure Buffalo and the Nashville did, and they probably had all these stats that showed all these kind of 50-50, 40-60 deals, and that this is how business is done. Now, the other problem, if you're a city, is do you want an NFL team or not? What is it worth to you to have that NFL team? And I remember when I was writing the book False Start, and I interviewed Carmen Policy at length for that. You know, he helped Al Warner get the Browns, and the bidding went up over $500 million. And Al's like, "That's it. I'm done. I'm not going any higher." Well, Policy had his sources telling him that a couple of the owners were willing to go up to a half a billion. And he said, "Al, go higher." They picked a number, by the way, $530 billion, which basically gave everybody else $530 million, excuse me, gave everybody else an extra million of the teams. And he said, finally, I said, "Al, this is just like a Picasso or a Rembrandt came on the market. They're not making any more. This is it. If you want one, you can't. It's not like, you know, you don't want a McDonald's. You could go down the street and open, you know, Dave and Terry's hamburger joint. You don't get to just go down the street and open up your own NFL place where you want. If you want to be in the NFL, you get squeezed by these. You got to pay and you get squeezed by these guys. Then you decide, what does it mean to your community?"
All right. Well, a lot to be worked out there. I think your point on the dome is a good one, Terry. It's important to Cleveland and to the economic development. And I think that's a good call. 12 or 15 dates a year is not enough. And Taylor Swift didn't even come, right?
No.
to the stadium they have. So, all right. Jimmy and D. Haslam talked about extensions coming down the line for Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry. Stop me if you want, Terry. I'm just kind of running through some of the headlines. Andrew Berry had some updates on Nick Chubb's rehabilitation and Deshaun Watson's rehabilitation. They're both apparently coming along really well. I thought this was interesting, Terry. So Kevin Stefanski was asked down at the league meetings about why Jameis Winston over Joe Flacco. And I pulled the quote, and I want to see if you notice anything in this quote, because I'm trying to become proficient at translating Kevin Stefanski transcripts. So,
By the way, before you go any farther, translating Stefanski requires prayer.
That's right. All right.
You have to pray for wisdom, because like even when he says like something about a player, like he says, "Well, Jerry Jeudy will need some more time, you know, need time to kind of get acclimated." But, but then again, that's true of every player. He always comes like the qualifier afterwards. It's like when he realized, "I just said something that might be considered a slightly negative, but then I got to go to that." All right. What did he say?
Well, this made me laugh. I want to see if you pick up on it. Kevin Stefanski, quote, "We're excited about Jameis. I think Jameis is a really, really talented young player. Just getting to know him over the course of the last couple of weeks, he's a great teammate. He's excited about helping the team. Obviously, we were able to bring in Tyler Huntley, another young player that we've competed against. I think it's just a matter of adding some good young players to the room." Did you notice what word was used three times in those five sentences that begins with a Y?
Instead of signing Methuselah or Rip Van Winkle, is that what we're saying here?
Yeah, pretty much.
And where a 29-year-old guy is a young player. Now, granted, as a quarterback, because they do play longer, of course, Joe Flacco proved that. I do like what Barry said, and I agreed with this part about Huntley. I don't know if you saw that. He said, "We were surprised he was available, and he's out there, so let's just bring him in."
Yeah, and I do think the age had a lot to do with it, Terry. I mean,
oh, sure.
Analytically driven teams, and the Browns have gained a reputation as being one of the sharpest in the league. Like, they know that there's a difference between 30 and 39, and Tyler Huntley's 26. And we talked last week about them never wanting to be stuck at quarterback again like they were last year. And, like, if you get younger and deeper, that's a good thing. So, anyway, I just thought that just made me chuckle when I saw the young,
exactly. Yeah. And, of course, if I'm running out, it's like the CIA has these guys that sit around and create worst-case scenarios. You know, what happens if Berlin attacks the United States or whatever? They have all these guys. Well, even though it seems totally improbable, you should have a guy in your front office or two to create worst-case scenarios, which we almost had last year with the Browns quarterback room, to make sure that you avoid it again this year. Now, I think, by the way, Jameis Winston, you know, came in and, you know, of course, won the award for the press conferences and talking about that. And I will be very interested to see how apparently he does have a relationship with Watson, but he kindly actually sort of set himself up as, you know, I'm the older guy here who can help Deshaun. You know, we're both African Americans from the Deep South, very similar college experiences. Deshaun at Clemson, Jameis at Florida State, some up and downs. You know, Jameis had very well documented problems when he was younger. Now, see, Jameis has got 6 years or more behind him since any last incidents. And so, and basically, it sounds like you're saying, I will really maybe not beat Deshaun over the head with everything, but I'm going to talk to him about not just football, but life. And that may help him. So that's a good thing. And
yeah, it was. It was as much mentor as teammate.
Yeah, with that press it was conference. Very, very interesting. It was an interesting tone.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've never quite heard one like that.
Yeah. All right, Terry, a couple more things from the NFL meetings. The Browns, Mary Kay Cabot has done a phenomenal job of narrowing this down, but she basically went through the 9 Eagles opponents who potentially could be playing them in the Friday night opener in Brazil and narrowed it down to here's why it's between the Browns and the Packers, because of they don't want to send a division opponent down there and all these other reasons and teams that had played overseas. So anyway, apparently the Browns and Packers have both sent people down to Brazil to scout out facilities, and we should hear pretty soon in terms of whether the Browns will be part of that game in Brazil against the Eagles to open the season. So, and then the other big thing that I didn't want to spend too much time on, but it's really interesting, Terry, kickoffs are going to be different, and my contention is they are going to matter again. And why this is important for Browns fans is, like, kickoffs since Josh Cribbs left, I don't know that many kickoffs have mattered at all to the Browns, because they haven't had many of them and they haven't had many people good at them back there. But here's the way it's going to work for people who haven't heard. The ball is going to be kicked off from the 35. And from what I understand, the other 10 guys attacking the kickoff are going to stand at the 40-yard line on the other side of the field. And then the returning team is going to stand 5 yards away from them. Those guys who are standing facing each other 5 yards apart cannot move until the ball drops down and is either caught by a guy or it hits the ground between the, I think it's the, let me see if I can get this right, between the 20 and the goal line, right? So those guys, there's going to be like 10 or 11, well, there'll be 10 guys on the kicking team and 9 guys, let's say, on the receiving team, 19 guys standing looking at each other 5 yards apart from each other, standing still. When the ball hits the landing zone between
are
the 20 and the goal line.
Are they playing cards or what are they doing when all this
is
going?
Yeah, it's a little rugby-ish to me. It reminds me of some rugby game. But once the ball hits, everybody goes. And if you want to watch some XFL highlights, you can see what it looks like. But the intent is, and the NFL's been trying to do this for years, is reduce the amount of concussions and guys running 40 yards full speed into each other they thought was raising the concussion level for the kickoff play. So they're hoping that this will turn kickoffs from being a stupid, not important play where you go to get a piece of pizza out of your fridge because you know you're not going to miss anything, to where it's going to matter. And I thought this was really interesting, Terry, and this is what I wanted to share. There's a guy named Mike Clay. I think he covers the NFL for ESPN. He's at Mike Clay NFL. He put together the percentage of kickoff returns per game for XFL and NFL teams last season. And I thought this was really interesting. So the Browns, on this list that he put together, there's 40 teams. The Browns had 0.6 kickoff returns per game last season. That means all the rest were touchbacks or out of bounds or whatever, right? 0.6, and that was near the bottom. The XFL teams that played with this rule, number 8 had 3.6 kickoff returns per game. Then it went to 3.9, 3.9, 4.0, 4.1, 4.4, 4.6, and 5.6. The team in the NFL, Orlando, in the XFL, had the most kickoff returns per game was Orlando, and they returned 5.6 per game with this kickoff format that the NFL is going to use. So that means the kickoffs, to me, are going to matter again. And oddly enough, the Steelers today have signed Cordarrelle Patterson, one of the great returners of the last 10 years, to their roster. So I think they saw this, and they're like, we got to get somebody, or maybe they were already thinking about this. I don't know. But I don't know. It's interesting, right?
As you are an expert in this, can't you just tell your kicker, kick that baby into Lake Erie?
You could, but there's a lot of guys who can't, you know, and if the weather's bad, and I don't know.
I just think that the 0.6 shows that these guys, they backed it up to what, the 35?
Yeah.
Okay, that makes a difference. Because they've been kicking from the 40?
Well, it went from the 40 to the 30 to 35. I'm trying to remember where kickoffs were last year. But anyway, it looks like it's going to be from the 35 in 2024. And they're going to try it for 1 year and see how it goes. But I just, you know, Browns fans remember what an exciting player Josh Cribbs was back in the day. And like, as soon as he was done, it seemed like the kickoff became.
Yeah, they had a little bit of a run with, remember the Travis Benjamin, what was he, the rabbit or the penguin or whatever. Yeah. But yeah, Cribbs was the ultimate. But I mean, one way around all that is most of these guys, when they want to, they can just kick that thing really deep. So I'll be curious to see. By the way, you just as I am the expert on kickers, you have now become the expert on the kickoff rules, the nuances of kickoffs, and all of that stuff. Well, and by the way, you ignored a big piece of news about kickers.
Cade York. Cade York has been re-signed by the Browns. There you go.
And I was pleased they did this because we all love Dustin Hopkins, the greatest kicker since Phil Dawson. But the reason they got Dustin Hopkins a year ago is because he pulls hamstrings. And we saw he did it again. And, of course, now they have to – must make a rule that, you know, you're like – you're walking home from Denver this year if you, like, chase a guy down. But you have to have a guy on your practice squad that you can put in a game, even if he's a little shaky. And Cade York, I mean, a lot of these guys, Phil Dawson was cut three times before he made it with the Browns. I wrote about that in Vintage Browns. It's fascinating to read him. He had all his accounts of being cut and what happened, including one time he tried out with the Steelers. They took him out to Old Three Rivers. They didn't even have a goalpost set up. And they just had him kind of kick in the direction, and they cut him. That was it. They didn't like what they saw. He's like, how do you even know? But in other words, though, it's critical that they did that. And York is a guy they know. And so why not?
Well, they're trying to make sure they have contingencies for contingencies for contingencies.
Amen.
And if he would come back, it makes total sense. And no harm, no foul. It looks like they're going to carry on. So,
and remember how panicked we were last year when the quarterback started getting hurt and then when Dustin got hurt. Because it isn't like, oh, we could throw, we could turn this, take the safety and turn him into a linebacker if we have to, or the guys could play different positions. Yes, I know David Njoku volunteered to kick, but nobody wanted to see it.
Especially Kevin Stefanski.
Yes.
All right, Terry, anything else on the Browns that came out of this week that you want to bring up?
I think that was it. But remember, you're the kickoff guy.
I'll put that down on my my LinkedIn kickoff
guy.
Coverage expert guy. Yeah. All right. Let's see. Real quick, hey, I want to mention our kind of sister podcast. It's called Dine Drink CLE, done by people we work with in the Cleveland.com newsroom who cover food and dining in Cleveland. There's all kinds of openings and closings and trends, and you can catch it all. Join Josh Duke and Alex Darris. They talk to people in town and talk to other experts in our newsroom, Mark Bona, Paris Wolf, Pete Chikarian, who know the food scene. Give it a listen anywhere you find podcasts, and you'll find a new restaurant. You can go out. Maybe it's Dave and Terry's Hamburger stand, whatever.
Yeah. An NFL franchise waiting. So
that's right. So. All right, Terry. A few weeks ago, you asked fans, you were telling a story about how you caught your one and only foul ball during a baseball game. And you asked fans to send in some emails about that. And we do have a couple here. I want to get to those before we wrap it up. So why don't we get into that? And we'll keep things moving here. So, all right, this one is from Bill Wise in Raleigh, North Carolina. He's formerly of Kent, Ohio. And he says, hey, guys, I never got a foul ball at an Indians game, but my dad got one at an armed forces game in Honolulu during World War II.
Wow.
After the game, he got two of the players, Schoolboy Rowe and Fred Hutchinson, to sign it. I still have it, but the signatures have faded to the point they can't be read. Wow, that's some balls. Schoolboy Rowe, man, he was around forever. I think, did he pitch for the Brooklyn Dodgers back in the day?
I think he did, yeah.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And my father played against a guy named Willard Marshall, played like 10 years for the Giants. He played against a guy named Johnny Beasley, who was a 20-game winner before World War II. Hurt his arm. My father said that they made him do all these pull-ups. He didn't want to, didn't feel good about it, hurt his arm. And then his master sergeant, whoever was running the team, kept pitching him. And he was never the same after that. And there was one or two other big leaguers he played with. So that was the other cool, you know, that was one of the things you think about that time in history. And I love history. It's my thing. There was a sort of evening out of thing. I mean, here was some guy who my father drove a plain dealer truck part-time and was working at Fisher Foods, went into the Army, and he's on a team with a couple of big leaguers playing against some other big leaguers. You have to be pretty good, you know. And so, and then they were at the same mess hall together and all that stuff.
Because yeah, out in the sandlot playing ball against each other, and you never know who you're going into. Yeah,
you never knew. Yeah. I mean, you know, Feller on the ship was always playing catch with these guys. He had all those stories, and you know, with the cooks in between or whatever it was. So, but that's a cool story.
Yeah, that's something. So thanks for that, Bill. This one is from John, and he says, "Hey guys, as I've shared in the past, I'm a longtime reader listener. In response to your foul ball podcast, I wanted to share a funny sort of foul ball story from old Cleveland Stadium. One night, sitting in left field watching warmups, the pitchers were getting their running in by catching fly balls thrown by one of the assistant coaches or trainers. It was obvious they had a contest going on to see who could catch the most flies in a row. Walking from center field to the left field bullpen, Jerry Willard decided to be funny and threw his catcher's mitt at one of the fly balls and knocked it down so that Rick Sutcliffe's streak was broken. Rick was upset and picked up the catcher's mitt, walked past Jerry, and threw the mitt into the stands about 10 rows up to a fan. Willard then had to negotiate with the fan to get the mitt back. The fan wanted an autographed ball by Sutcliffe and Bert Blyleven to return the mitt. Both pitchers initially refused for drama purposes, but ultimately agreed. Willard then brought the signed ball to the fence and was getting ready to sign the ball as well when the fans stopped him, saying they would keep the mitt if he signed. Willard was a little embarrassed but obliged and gave the fan the ball signed by both pitchers and got his catcher's mitt back. It was a very funny scene as the pitchers tortured the young catcher and one I will never forget. Thanks for all your years of dedication, Terry. Your efforts are appreciated and hope to see you at Lakeside this summer." Again, that's from John. So,
all right, here we go. Two stories off of this because I was covering the Tribe back then. Remember, there was a baseball writer before Paul Hoynes, and that was me. So that was from 80 through 84. I covered them. All right. The guy throwing the fly balls was Don McMahon, the pitching coach, who would just heave these things. Don McMahon also was a obsessive pickup basketball player. And when we would go out in spring training and play pickup basketball, sometimes on the road, he, especially Roberta, who played on Hiram's first team, he always drafted Roberta because she could make 12 footers. And he would say, he was a big wide guy, and he would set these picks that like just crunch people and say, "Roberta, shoot." And she would shot better than I did. So he did that, but he had this huge arm that he could just throw. And his idea was, he was old school. You run a lot, you throw a lot. So Jerry Willard went to the trainer's room. He had a sore throat. He wasn't feeling very well. Jimmy Warfield, the trainer, said, "Here's what you need to do, Willard. Get Luke, here's some salt, and just gargle in lukewarm water." Whereupon Willard asked, "Where do you get lukewarm water?" And Warfield said, "I suggest the faucet."
Oh, that's classic. It's like the old Paul Harvey thing. Yeah. He used to do this. Now you know the rest of the story.
The rest of the story. From Terry Pluta. Which is why the other players would just, he had that way of just saying stupid stuff, you know. He seemed like a decent enough guy, but it's like part of common sense just evaded Jerry Willard. I know when he was catching, the pitchers hated it because he was not engaged in the game plan at all.
Classic. Well, thanks for that story, Terry. And then we're still going through. We have about four of these left, and this is from back when we had our 100th episode. We asked fans to write in why they're a Cleveland fan and where they live now, why they're still connected to Cleveland fandom. And this one comes from Nina Lewin, and her maiden name was Glass, so Nina Glass Lewin. And she says, "I grew up in Cleveland and left in 1975 when I married a Canadian. I've been a devoted and passionate fan of all Cleveland sports, but my heart is with the Browns. While living in Toronto, I've watched the Browns, Indians, and Cavs all the time. When I had football heartbreak, as the Browns lost those two Denver games, I still cheered every season. I cheered and cheered and felt such disappointment in my team. My kids would say, "Mom, choose another team." I said, "My heart is with the Browns." So I continue to cheer. And now, what fun to talk about my team. I follow Terry and you. She says, "I follow Terry, and you know we agree on most things. I also like that Terry's a man of peace and good stuff in life. He has wonderful, uplifting stories." Well, nothing more to be said. Go Browns, go Guardians, go Cavs. And again, that's from Nina Lewin. Thanks for that, Nina. And we appreciate you checking in from, we think, Canada. So good letter.
You know, when I wrote Vintage Browns, it was partly because I was talking to Bernie somewhere. We were just there. And it's like he mentioned how people bring up the drive and the fumble and all that. And those teams of the 80s were from Red Right 88 to the drive, the fumble. It's like they were defined by that. And that's ridiculous. They were great entertainment. They were really good guys. They were embraced by the community. To this day, those players are revered. Okay, so they didn't win a Super Bowl. In my mind, that does not take away anything from what they accomplished. And of course, you watch what happened after that. So that's why I think she's right on it now. And that's why, for example, last year was so much fun. But they had years like that, year after year of winning 10 games and getting to the playoffs. And okay, getting knocked out. But you know, you thought, and then you walked out. I was like, okay, the Browns got blown out this year in Houston. But I felt good about the team, and I like most of their players and that. So that's a lot of what sports is.
Yeah, and those teams back then, Terry, have made so many Browns fans for so many years after that because of the attachment between that group of players and coaches and the fans here. So it still lives on, even though their time on the field has passed. So, all right, I think we're done here. Anything else you want to mention? Anything coming up we should talk about?
No, I guess that's about it. But so you have to just study up on that kickoff rule.
I will. I'm gonna get my PhD in kickoff coverage for to add it to my LinkedIn, and that'll do it. So the Guardians start Thursday night. They have some late games out in Oakland. We'll be talking about that next week, and we'll see what happens with the Cavs here the next week.
Oh, I think we're one good, last Terry. Thing. Oh, yeah. I forgot to mention on the Guardians. Absolutely thrilled to see Carlos Carrasco show up in Goodyear in January, get that arm in shape, pitch well in spring training and win a job and say, "I'll go in the bullpen. I'll start. I'll do whatever you want," at the age of 37, a man who beat leukemia. And again, that's a player you could cheer for.
And they kept his number for him, which I thought was really cool.
Amen to that too.
Yeah. So he'll be wearing the same number and be just like old times. So, all right. Thanks everybody for listening. Terry and I are going to go search out some lukewarm water to cleanse our palate. We'll talk to you next week on Terry's Talking.